Welcome to Canadian Politico. I'm Cameron Bishop.
I'm Leanne Goodman.
And I'm Mike McDougall.
And today on the pod, I'm going to sit down and talk about the opioid crisis with Dr. Hickey Gurani, an addiction medicine and public health specialist and assistant professor for the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Alberta. It's going to be a really solid conversation. I learned a lot. Hope you will as well. Also, in 2 weeks, we'll be sitting down with activists to talk about the Me Too movement, how to build workplaces that are truly equitable, and how men in particular in society in general can keep the lessons of Me Too top of mind in building a healthy social construct. Also, coming up in March, this is kind of cool, Liberal MP Nathaniel Erskine-Smith is going to sit down and talk about the need for drug legalization, decriminalization. So we've got a couple good shows coming up in the next few weeks. But now, first off, let's talk to my two co-hosts here. So we'll start with Leanne first. Tell me a little bit about yourselves and why you guys agreed to come on this nascent podcast with no listeners.
I am the politics and business editor at a website called The Conversation, which is a big global online news publication that started in Australia and is going gangbusters all over the world. And we have just started the Canadian chapter of it. So it's very fun. I spent a large part of my career at the Canadian Press for almost 30 years. It seems hard to believe, but I did start there when I was 12. and I was the White House correspondent for a while there. That was probably the highlight of my career, was covering the Obama administration. And so I'm delighted. I'm very politically engaged, so I'm delighted to take part in this podcast, which I'm sure is going to become a huge success story.
Yeah, really, just like a tsunami of success is coming at us. Mike, go for it.
Well, I have no idea how I'm going to follow that up. I mean, I work in post-secondary education. I've worked in education for my whole career. I've spent some time overseas working in the international world, again, in education. But I'm much more of a layman than I think the other two people in this podcast. I mean, I've known Cameron for a little while. We've had this ongoing political conversation, and this was kind of the next outline for effectively what we've been talking about for the last few years. So I'm just excited to be a part of the team until you guys realize that you need to kick me off.
Well, I don't know if this is Survivor, I might be the one first voted off the island. I don't know how well this is going to shake out, but what the hell? Let's just dive right in. I guess I should say something about myself. I used to work on the Hill. I'm not too sure if that's a badge of honor anymore, but I did for about 10 years, finishing up as press secretary to Carolyn Bennett, the former public health minister. Now I'm a lobbyist in my professional career, but that is not neither here nor there. So we'll just move on. All right. So let's dive right in. And I was going to start with something relatively light, but instead I figure, you know what, let's just talk about something that is top of mind that maybe isn't the easiest thing to talk about. Let's talk about the Colton Bushy tragedy. What it means for Canada, what steps the government needs to take to address it. And for listeners who aren't familiar with the Bushy trial, Colton Bushy was a 22-year-old First Nations man and a resident of the Cree Red Pheasant First Nation in Saskatchewan. Last August, or I guess it was 2 Augusts ago, August 9th, 2016, Colton and his friends apparently got a flat tire in a truck that they had apparently previously stole after attempting to rob another homeowner in the area while drinking and driving, and went to a farmhouse owned by 56-year-old Saskatchewan farmer Jerry Stanley to seek help. They get onto the Stanley property. One of them steals an ATV there, and their vehicle crashed into one of Stanley's cars. Stanley then goes and gets an old handgun. He fires two warning shots in the air. Then he shoots Bushy in the head at point-blank range, kills him instantly. Of course, Stanley arrested, charged with second-degree murder. But just this past February the 9th, he's acquitted by an all-white jury, sparking outrage in Canada, triggering protests across the country. Bernice King, daughter of the late Martin Luther King Jr., said on Twitter that the Colton Bushy verdict was a, quote, painful reminder that racism and systemic injustice are world issues, not just American issues. Colonial leaves in its wake, death and destruction across the globe. The more we shun change, the more death and destruction comes. You matter. And then, of course, the Prime Minister, Justice Ministers, Indigenous Services Minister Jane Philpott, all said that we need to do better, committed to reviewing this. And the conservatives said, you know, it's a very sad tragedy, but quit politicizing it, get rid of political interference. So, folks, what do we think? Bad verdict, obviously.
You know, I wasn't in the courtroom. I didn't hear it. So, you don't want to completely vilify the jury, but it doesn't make sense to me. You had the manslaughter option. And if this is a manslaughter, I don't know what is. His defense is that he didn't really mean to raise the gun to head level and that he didn't really mean to pull the trigger. I don't understand how a jury does not convict on manslaughter anyway. And, you know, it reminds me very much of the case that I covered a lot of in the States, the Trayvon Martin case. There's a lot of similar themes and similarities. Again, unarmed kid shot after an altercation. And honestly, that was one story that made me want to leave the U.S. and come back to Canada, because I thought that kind of thing couldn't happen here, that the visceral hatred for this kid and the people who really believed that he had what was coming to him was really disturbing to me. And then I come here and I'm seeing some of the same outrage on the other side. I don't really understand why it is wrong for Justin Trudeau to weigh in on this, but Obama was faced with the same outrage by conservatives when he weighed in on Trayvon Martin. So I find it disturbing, but if there's a silver lining, perhaps we're going to reassess how we pick jurors and how the Indigenous are treated by the justice system. So perhaps that's one silver lining for this poor family that I feel so bad for.
What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, well, I was just going to kind of jump in. I echo a lot of what Leanne just said there. But, you know, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in this case as well, where people, I mean, you know, I go on my Facebook page and I see people all over my Facebook page lately, because everyone's a big political commentator on social media, and people can't seem to get over what they think happened before the kid got shot. And at the end of the day, this kid was executed. I mean, he was shot in the back of the head with a gun. And to say, oh, I didn't really mean to shoot him, why did you have a gun? What's the point in bringing a gun into any situation if you don't plan on shooting it? And he already had shot it twice in the air as warning shots. I don't know if he watches too many cowboy movies, or it is Saskatchewan, I guess. But, you know, like the point that he brought a gun into a situation and then says he didn't mean to use it is ridiculous. The kid, it doesn't really matter. The smoke and mirrors in the sense of, you know, did he try to steal an ATV? Was a car stolen? Did he crash into a car? None of that matters in the sense that a gun was put to the back of this kid's head and he was shot.
Yeah, nobody
This isn't this isn't France in 1760, right? This isn't how we deal with. He's not the police. Obviously, the punishment outweighs the crime, but it just goes into systematic, you know, oppression that Indigenous people in Canada have suffered forever in this country. And we have an issue, and we like to think as Canadians that we're nice and we don't have the same problems that America does. And I hate comparing us to America because we're not America, but we do have these problems, and, you know, we need to address them instead of saying, well, he tried to steal an ATV. That's just ridiculous.
Well, and, you know, the crazy thing is yeah, we aren't Americans, and we like to pat ourselves on the back of being more polite. I think that all that means is that we cover our shit up a lot better than other people do, and we tend to want to ignore it.
Agree. There is a myth of Canadian politeness and a myth of Canadian inclusiveness.
I agree.
We see it all the time playing out, and then we pretend that we're very smug about how we're superior to the Americans on that stuff, but stories like this show us that we're not. Also, the Indigenous population makes up only 4% of the Canadian population, and they make up 24% of the prison population. And a lot of those convictions have to do with mental health issues, drug addiction issues, acting out due to childhood abuse. I don't think prison is the place for these people. And this is just another story that sort of underscores just how terribly we treat the Indigenous on every front, including the criminal justice system.
Can I just, one thing I want to say before we close this off, and I'd love to get your guys' thoughts, is on the issue of, I know none of us are lawyers, but on peremptory challenges, 14 of the jurors were all white, and the Crown, under the peremptory I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, peremptory challenges, they are allowed to use, in this case, up to 14 of these so-called challenges to dismiss a juror. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, there was a huge number of Indigenous potential jurors that were there, but I find it really hard to fathom how 14 white jurors, and I'm not suggesting, I know I've talked with other people about this, how, you know, well, of course, you know, what are you saying that white people can't be jurors in an Indigenous case? Well, no, but for Christ's sake, like, is there no diversity at all in Saskatchewan? The Crown just kind of sits around and pisses around and tries to find people that look exactly like everybody else in this country. And then we wonder why the verdict comes back the way it does.
And actually, Saskatchewan has a pretty high Indigenous population compared to other provinces. So there probably there's suggestions that there were as many as 5 Indigenous people in the original pool. I mean, I guess it's a no-brainer why the defense is not going to go for an Indigenous juror in this case. But it's funny you ask this question because we're trying to get this story today from an academic at the University of Saskatchewan to talk about peremptory challenges and is it unlimited? In the U.S., you know, they only have so many challenges. So do we know how this is used in this case? And so we're trying to get that story. So next week, maybe I'll have an answer to that question.
God love you. Anybody want to take a round out on the Conservatives' political interference argument, or should we just move on? Come on, Leah. You know, I'm baiting you.
Obama faced the same thing. Like, remember he said Trayvon Martin could have been my kid, and he just got pilloried. And I disagree. I disagree that that's political interference to hold out, you know, to say publicly that you are heartbroken for that family. I don't know how that's not, that to me is just being a humane political leader who is a leader of all of us as Canadians, not just the white people. Anyway, well, and maybe Mike feels differently. What do you think, Mike?
I'm just I think this is also, we're kind of inundated with, you know, partisan politics being fought in the media. And this is a different topic for a different podcast, but I'm so sick of, you know, when any politician acts human, one side says that they're wrong, the other side lauds them for it. And it's, you know, it's another topic, I think. I mean, the Conservatives are jumping on Trudeau now because Trudeau was human. But if Trudeau had not said anything, I really suspect that there would have been comments that he's not engaged and doesn't care about the Indigenous population. So that's just, again, it's just lay it on thick, folks, right? Like, I mean, come on.
Well, hey,
what are they supposed to do?
And just remember.
And they can't win, right? You're right.
There's no winning.
But I do want to remind you, Andrew Scheer did say this past weekend at the Manning Conference that compassion is what Conservatives do. So it's certainly on display this week when they shit all over the Prime Minister for being compassionate. Okay.
I like that we can swear on this podcast.
You can swear. You can do anything you want, right, Leanne, within reason. I don't know if the CRTC will come kick my ass or something, but I guess I'm not successful enough yet. All right. Quickly on this topic, and then we'll close out on one more, but further west, let's talk about the dispute between Alberta and BC, wine and whining. Despite approval by the National Energy Board for the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which would triple capacity for the Kinder Morgan Pipeline, the BC NDP government banned the expansion of oil imports through the province last month in an attempt to stop the pipeline, which, of course, is incredibly unpopular in BC. Although if you're reading Premier Notley's Twitter feed lately, she's been tweeting out all sorts of letters that she's been getting from BC folks to try and pull pressure. But here, this lady who has been absolutely pilloried by folks like Jason Kenney and all sorts of folks on the right who in 10 years didn't manage to do dick squat all on pipelines, decides that she's going to ban BC wine and importation and sales in the province at a cost of $70 million to BC winemakers. You know, the PM and others are committed to getting the pipeline built. Well, the conservative band of naysayers, as always, are dumping on the feds. So what do we think? No BC wine for Albertans and a lot of whining from BC, or totally justified?
You know, I guess the Ontario winemakers are happy. You know, I'm not where you might expect I am on this issue. I kind of feel bad for the oil producers. Like, they want and need to get their product to market. Having said that, I also totally agree with First Nations communities that don't want those pipelines coming through their line. It's a really difficult issue. Like, it would be beneficial to Canada if we could get this product to market. There's a demand for it. But on the other hand, like sometimes I've wondered, why don't we just build our own refinery in Alberta?
It's the endless question.
Refine it and then ship, right? Like if they'd done that 10, 15 years ago, we'd have one and this pipeline issues would not be, dominating the tensions between the U.S. and Canada on Keystone. It's a tough issue. I'm not, I can see every side of it. So I don't know. But interprovincial trade wars, I mean, wow, are we really, that's really where we're going?
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, there's been reported over 80 spills in the last 50 years. That's what I'm reading. And I'm certainly not an expert in this, but at the end of the day, I don't think having conversations on environmental issues are a bad thing. But you're right. I mean, build a refinery in Alberta, build one in BC. We don't need, I mean, if the concerns of the people that live in the area of the pipeline, if they're valid, then respect them and move forward. Yeah. But banning wine, why ban wine? I mean, point of this?
I grew up in Fort McMurray. I like to say I'm an oil sands kid. I mean, it helped me to get through school. It put food on the table, what have you. I'm all about making sure that oil flows where it needs to flow in the safest possible way. And frankly, that's a pipeline. And I think that Rachel Notley, who gets, dumped on regularly as being some sort of, champagne socialist who doesn't get it. You know, I love that it's taken an NDP premier to come in and kick ass and try and push hard for a pipeline. So I say, fuck, all the power to you, Premier. Make it hurt. Make it hurt hard for BC. Because, a lot of people up in Fort McMurray, a lot of people in the oil patch in Alberta, they have had the stuffing absolutely beat out of them. And so they need this. We need this. And frankly, I say go hard, shut down Mission Hill or whatever wineries that are in the Okanagan just by doing this. Like I would just tighten the vise so hard on this because Horgan needs those seats if he wants a majority. And I just turn those screws until he was blue.
Wow.
But most of these wineries are small businesses.
Well,
right? To punish the wineries, a lot of these wineries are small businesses that are run by, entrepreneurs that started their own wineries. So you want to put out, you're talking about people with jobs, people that work in, massive oil companies are now going to take it out on the little guy, so to speak, metaphorically. But it's just, you're going to cancel wine. You call her a champagne socialist and what she banned? Champagne. Like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, hey, listen, there's a solution. Give us the pipeline. Number one. Number two, the little guys also work for the big oil companies and they need to be able to put food on their table too. So this is an issue that's rubbing up against each other. But to be honest, keep on it, Premier. So this is my show. I can say fucking go for it, Premier.
Go for it.
Okay, last one. And then I'm going to let you guys out. But let's do something a little half lighter anyway. Start south of the border with President Pussy Grabber. This past week, White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter forced to resign after allegations as well as photo evidence that he had abused both his former wives. I think one of the photos showed that she had a big old black eye. I mean, this shit that you're hearing is terrible. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly claims ignorance about the issue despite a CNN report indicating that he and other senior White House aides knew that he was having trouble obtaining security clearance and then he'd been accused of domestic abuse by his ex-wives. They do an Oval Office scrum with Trump and Trump's like, he says he's innocent and I think you have to remember that. It's my best Trump impression. He also tweets out that, quote, people's lives are being shattered and destroyed by a mere allegation. Some are true, some are false, some are old and some are new. There is no recovery for someone falsely accused. Life and career are gone. Is there no such thing any longer as due process? I set this up, Mr. Due Process is the same man who has previously accused Hillary of working with the Russians, Obama of being a Kenyan, Ted Cruz's dad having killed Kennedy. Not to mention, the guy's got his own allegations. What, like 13 women have accused him of sexual assault? Grab him by the pussy, Dingo Donald there. With Billy Bush, what else? Oh, raping his first wife. I mean, come on. What do we think?
Lock her up, right?
Yeah, that's
it. Still calls her crooked Hillary. I edited a piece yesterday about how politicians shouldn't pursue other politicians because it tends to diminish free speech. But I've never understood why Hillary Clinton doesn't sue Trump for continuing to call her a criminal and chanting lock her up. You know, as a woman, none of this surprises me. This is not an administration that cares about women. Ivanka Trump doesn't care about women, despite all her bullshit posturing that she does.
Yes, and her third world, out, her third world factory manufactured clothes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so as a woman, I find this to be one of the most appalling political administrations in the Western world ever. I don't ever recall there being such a disregard for women or women's issues. He's always mocking the women's marches and, you know, suggesting women should just be grateful that he's president. None of this surprises me. These people aren't going to care that there's a wife beater in the White House. It's coming out now. ABC is reporting that even despite the photos, Rob Porter was trying to tell people that they were just, you know, household mishaps, just minor squabbles, no big deal.
Yeah, always lay into your spouse with a fist or some broken glass. That's a minor squabble for sure.
Yeah, and you know, this is one of the first things I think that's really hurting John Kelly, because he looks like he was lying about what he knew and when he knew it.
Well, he was lying.
Story.
He was lying.
John Kelly's done.
Well,
I hope so. Well, apparently Trump wants him to be done, too. Trump doesn't like that he's trying to rein him in as much as he is. And Trump is actually trying to interview for a replacement and to get rid of him because, you know, God forbid, nobody puts baby, orange baby in a corner. So I'm trying not to seethe with hatred and contempt for this administration, but it's not a conservative versus liberal thing, a Republican versus Democrat thing. I actually really liked Mitt Romney. And when you look back at this situation now, Mitt Romney sort of looks like a Christ figure. But it's just, this guy isn't a Democrat. He's not even really a conservative or a liberal. He's just a political opportunist who surrounded himself with a bunch of terrible people. And I just really do hope that he gets impeached.
They're the very best people.
Yeah. I'm just,
he does only hire the best people, Leanne. He only hires the best people.
The very best.
And this is an anomaly. He's not normal under any circumstances, and neither is this whole administration. So, you know, I can only hope that he gets impeached, which I keep hearing is very likely to happen, although who knows? It depends on whether the Republicans start the process. And maybe if they get completely wiped out in the midterms, they will. Then maybe that's what it's going to take. And I hope that they do get wiped out in the midterms. But I just, you know, I all the polls showed that Hillary Clinton had it in the bag. And now the polls are showing that the Democrats are going to kick ass in 2000 or, you know, in November. And I don't believe anything anymore. Nothing that happens now would surprise me.
What about you, Mike?
Well, I just think, I mean, this is a story, the whole Trump White House is a story that's kind of beaten to death. But I think, you know, when you look at who works for Trump, right? So you look at the White House and you kind of think, you know, if you really look into, you know, that Republican primaries that happened, there was, I'm making this up, but wasn't there like 16 or 17 people running for the nomination at one point?
17, I think, yeah.
17. So Trump got, you know, the people that, like, he's got what that, like, Seb Gorski, and he's got, you know, like, people that no other campaign would possibly have on. So when you have a White House where, you know, there's two people now that are accused of domestic assault, I mean, you know, the story that's trying to come up in the you know, most media is trying to say, you know, how could these people not have security clearances, which they didn't. They're saying that, you know, it takes a long time, which probably isn't true. But they're saying, you know, how can the White House try to cover this up? But you have to, the way I look at it is the people that are in the White House, they're all terrible people because they're all working. They're all people that the Trump campaign pulled out of whatever hole they were hiding in that other candidates didn't touch with a 10-foot pole. And they're the people in the Trump White House. So, I mean, it's just a...
You've seen that pipe, that river
of
shit.
And the people who aren't terrible are leaving.
You know that scene in Shawshank Redemption where that guy... crawls through a
Andy
pipe
Dufresne.
Full of Andy Dufresne through that 500-yard pipe full of shit. I think that is actually a better place than where Trump found his people. I mean, that probably smells better. It's a higher quality organism in that pipe than where Trump gets his ethics and his employees.
Well, Leanne, you covered the White House. Half the people that are in this administration right now, have you heard of any of them before now?
Well, Dina Powell, I had, but she's left. Yeah, there's some. There were some that went in thinking, like John Kelly and McMaster and the other guy's name.
Priebus was pretty big before this, wasn't he, too, right?
Yeah, and, you know, some of them are doing it because they're fearful of what will happen if they don't do it. And that's kind of what John Kelly's doing, right? Like,
yeah.
there's a cabal of these guys who are actually fairly well respected in D.C. who are not giving up on it because they're afraid of what he will do and what he's capable of if there's not an adult in the room. So, yeah, I had heard of some of them. But, you know, a lot like, you know, Bannon, God, nobody had really paid any attention to that guy.
That guy is just a puss weasel.
And that Stephen Miller guy who's just a terrible human being.
Oh, God.
Right. And what bothers me most about Trump is I'm not even sure that he believes any of this stuff. There's an Axios report. I don't know if you guys follow Axios.
Yeah.
It's a little niche. It's good. It's some guys from Politico started it up, and they have a story today, I guess, or maybe I read it last night about how Trump totally believes privately that Porter is a wife beater, has no doubt in his mind that he did it. And then says something completely opposite publicly. Because he is inciting his 30% base of lunatics. And apparently that's what a lot of stuff that he believes privately, he says the opposite publicly, just to have his terrible base of mean, angry, uneducated white men continue to support him, which to me, I think that's worse because it means you're such an opportunist and you are cynically exploiting these terrible tragedies like Charlottesville.
God.
Just
good people. Good people on both sides, Leanne. Good people on both sides.
And that people can still defend him after that. That to me, that was the moment where it's like, if you're still on this guy's side when he's standing up for white supremacists, I don't know why any of the black people showed up for the Martin Luther King Jr. ceremony recently that he oversaw. Like, I just would have boycotted that thing.
Yeah.
To me, that was the moment where, but I don't even necessarily believe that he, actually, I do think he's a racist.
Well,
now.
He is. No, this is a guy whose organization used to stamp C on the applicants of African-Americans on their rental applications. Colored. Give me a break.
I don't mean to stress that I don't think he's a racist, but I do think he's a racist. But I also think he knows he's going down. This is a theory that I've heard, that he knows that they've got him on obstruction of justice and possibly money laundering. He knows he's going down. So as he's going down, he's trying to incite like almost riots. He wants his base to go completely crazy if he is, you know, ousted from the White House. So he's stirring up all this stuff, which to me is worse.
I think you're giving him too much credit. I think you're giving him too much credit to have a plan that is that sophisticated and long-term.
True.
I honestly believe
he's playing,
that he wakes
he's playing
up every
eight-dimensional
day
chess, guys. He's playing eight-dimensional chess, and we're all a bunch of simpletons still struggling with checkers.
No, I don't believe
I don't
that.
Think
I think
he's
actually really stupid, too. I do think he's stupid. I'm going to say this. I think he's a stupid asshole, which is the worst kind of asshole. You can be an asshole or you can be stupid, but you can't be a stupid asshole, right? Because then you're taking your stupidity and you're thrusting it on everyone else in an arrogant, awful manner.
I don't need a visual of Trump thrusting. I don't know.
Because Bush was dumb, but he wasn't an asshole. He surrounded himself by assholes. Now we've got, and we've also had assholes who are just plain assholes. But anyway,
well, what do they say
smart.
About
like an intelligent asshole doesn't bother me as much, but a dumb asshole is the absolute worst type of combination of person. And that's what we've got with this guy.
Mike, sorry.
Anyway.
I cut you off there before we
that's
wrap
okay.
Up.
I can't follow that up. So I'm just going to,
I think you're right. I think I am giving him too much credit. I take it back.
Wow. All right. I was going to put Leanne down for undecided, but I think she's definitely now in the Trump's an asshole category, so that's good. The only other question I have for you guys, and it's just kind of, you know, when you said that Axios report was talking about how Trump believes privately that Rob Porter actually was a, quote, sick puppy and did beat his wives. What the fuck does that say about him? He's got 13 abuse allegations, and God, take a look at Melania anytime she's around him. And she looks like, she is a victim. But although I've had some people say to me, Mile, when you marry for money, by God, you're going to have to earn every penny. So she stands there and smiles and puts up with it. But I mean, what the hell's going on there?
you know, I heard rumors. I know people who, I have a friend who's, I have a friend who's connected to very wealthy people in New York. And the story about them is, firstly, she lives on a different floor in the Trump Tower, only speaks, what is she, Latvian?
Slovakian.
Yes, Slovenian.
Slovenian.
Whatever it is. Anyway, and she wanted out after the pussy grabbing stuff had come out. And nobody thought he was going to win. The family did not think he was going to win. She was just enduring it. And then the pussy stuff came out and she's like, that's it. I'm done. I didn't want to do this anyway. He's forced me into this bullshit political campaign. This isn't what I signed up for. When this election is over and Hillary Clinton is president, I am out. And then he won. So you kind of have to feel for her on that regard. Like now she's stuck. But maybe that's giving her too much credit too.
I think it is. What about you, Mike?
I mean, I'm not going to jump into, you know, the kind of the victim of Melania Trump. I think, I mean, I see her as more a tragic figure than anything else. I'm basing her based on her public image, which is the only thing I have access to, but she certainly doesn't look engaged or like she wants to be there. And we have no idea what's going on in her head. And from what I can see, all she's really trying to do is raise her son and not have him thrust in the spotlight as best as she can. So I feel some sympathy for her.
Yeah, wow. Me too.
What a nice way to end the show. I will trash it up by just saying I also feel bad because there's no way anybody should have somebody like Donald Trump crawling on top of them. And if you can imagine that, some sort of sweaty orange mess. At any rate, that is tragic.
Laughing around.
Well, thanks, you guys.
Thanks, you guys.
So we are joined by Dr. Hakeek Virani, as I said in the intro, addiction and medicine and public health specialist physician out of Edmonton and assistant clinical professor for the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Alberta. And also just the very first official Politico supporter here on the pod. So welcome, Hakeek.
Hey, thank you. It's an honor.
Yeah, well, and thanks for bugging me for the last 2 years to do this. Sorry I was a little bit slow on the uptake, but...
I wasn't bugging you so that you'd talk to me, but I'm glad you're talking to somebody.
Well, yeah, well, listen, the guest list, the request list has gone out. It's relatively short right now. I'm not too sure that anybody wants to be on the pod, but thank God somebody does, and that's you. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with the opioid crisis in Canada, and you're very well positioned to be speaking about it. Just by way of background for folks who are listening, we are in the midst of a public health crisis here in Canada. We had over 4,000 opioid-related deaths in 2017. We know that the problem's acute everywhere, but especially acute in Western Canada. And Health Canada reported last year between January and June 2017, 74% of the apparent opioid-related deaths involved fentanyl or fentanyl analogs versus only 53% in 2006. So I guess, Hakeek, how bad is this and how the hell did we get here?
Well, I think the scariest part to me is that we can still say we're in the midst of a crisis. And this started years ago, as you know. And you'd think that with a bold and nimble public health response that we wouldn't be in the midst of an epidemic 2, 3, 4 years into it. And in fact, when we talk about the genesis of the epidemic, the beginnings were pretty obvious years ago. And years before, 4 or 5 years ago, in fact, more than a decade ago here in Alberta, the College of Physicians and Surgeons, along with the Provincial Government Health Department, Alberta Health Services, which is our single regional health authority in the province, had assembled a group of people who were concerned about what appeared to be a growing crisis with respect to prescription opioids. So the things that weren't illicit fentanyl that were being traded on the street, that we were seeing increasing demand for those pills on the street, and where we were seeing people who were prescribed opioids chronically and people who were prescribed opioids acutely for acute pain conditions were suffering from increasing numbers of adverse health effects from those, including overdose death. And so I think that when we talk about the genesis of this crisis, we can't ignore that the way that physicians prescribed opioids, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, really underpinned this epidemic.
So when we talk about the opioid crisis and we talk about prescription overprescribing by physicians, should we be, you know, siloing that? Is it strictly a prescription opioid crisis, or is it also a heroin crisis? And how do those two marry up?
Well, it's increasingly not an exclusively prescription opioid crisis. But, you know, there is no delineation between prescribed opioids and unprescribed opioids and licit opioids versus illicit opioids. They all meld together in a demand for opioid drugs. So part of that supply comes from the way that we prescribe, but much of that increasing supply now is coming from a variety of illicit sources and mostly imported from China. One of the reasons that we're seeing fentanyl and fentanyl analogs being imported into the illicit drug trade here is that those are your most easy to traffic opioid drugs. So if you wanted to move a million doses of heroin or a million doses of morphine, you're looking at 50 to 100 times the weight of moving the equivalent number of doses of fentanyl, and even more of the weight for some of these fentanyl analogs. So the corollary to that is that moving the easiest to traffic opioids is also moving the most toxic opioids, because the smallest amount of them will cause a greater effect. And that's why we're seeing that the proportion of people using opioid drugs who die from that use has gone way up. So we can't really say with certainty that it's an addiction epidemic, in that we're not sure that the raw number of people who are addicted to opioid drugs has gone way up, and certainly not in proportion to the number of people who are dying from them. So this is very much a drug toxicity crisis.
So then at the very base level, you know, what should doctors be doing on the prescription side? Should we be stopping prescribing opioids writ large at the outset? And I guess on that as well, when you're in medical school, what does your addiction and pain management training look like?
Well, I'll start by saying it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that you and I will probably talk for longer than the time that we spend in medical school learning about how to manage pain and how to manage addiction that arises from pain treatment. It doesn't happen very much at all. And where we had gotten education in the late 90s and early 2000s was essentially from pharmaceutical companies who manufactured these drugs and told us, without good evidence, that the chronic management of pain, non-cancer pain with chronic opioid therapy had very few risks, that the risk of developing disordered use or addiction to opioids was essentially nil, and that we could perpetually keep people on opioids and improve function, quality of life, and pain management without having to worry about adverse effects outside of addiction, including overdose death. We know that those things now are untrue. That said, it's hard to ignore that in places where there's been a turnaround in the amount of opioids prescribed in a population, there has not been a corresponding decrease in overdose deaths most of the time. And in fact, in some places, a large decrease in the prescribing of opioids to a population has been associated with an increase in overdose deaths.
Because they go off onto the street.
Well, I don't know that we can say with certainty because why.
Right.
But we can say that there is an association, and certainly on an individual level, there's no shortage of stories that I hear from patients seeking out treatment for addiction where that is the case, where they were prescribed opioids for a long period of time. The physician became concerned. There was a dialing back of their prescribed opioids. The patient continued to have pain or withdrawal and sought out other sources of opioids. And unfortunately, today is the worst day that you can, in history, that you can go out to the street and expect to find a safe opioid drug.
Is part of this too that, you know, governments in an age of cost savings, they'll buy cheaper generic drugs because that's what they want to make sure that is available on their formularies so that it doesn't cost them as much. While at the same time, they're delisting programs like massage, acupuncture, those kind of things that would commonly be used to treat for pain, so that really the only opportunity that a doctor has, unless a patient has private insurance, is to write a script for whatever, hydromorphone or OxyContin or whatever the case may be. Because we have delisted the very programs, it wouldn't necessarily require a pill for a mild to moderate pain indication.
Well, there's no question that one of the easiest things for us to do in medicine is to prescribe a drug that affects the entire body and brain. And you're right that you know, the system is not set up for us to think of non-pharmacotherapies for a whole variety of things, especially in pain management, where our goals should be improving, you know, quality of life and function, and may not always be a dramatic reduction in pain. It does require us to spend time with our patients, and it does require us to be creative about what interventions are tried or and what interventions are funded. So yeah, if what's possible for a patient to gain access to is a drug, you can expect that that will be the intervention most likely applied. And unfortunately, that doesn't marry up with what the evidence suggests is effective. Chronic opioid therapy is not as effective as we thought. And in fact, the risks of it may well be substantial.
So can you just talk about a little bit about fentanyl itself? So, you know, before it was OxyContin, and now everything everybody hears is fentanyl, fentanyl, fentanyl. Yeah. What is fentanyl, and why is it killing people so quickly and so indiscriminately?
Well, all opioids come from the opium poppy, or are synthetic variants of molecules that may come from the opium poppy. And they include drugs like codeine and Tylenol 3s and 4s and 1s and 2s. Now, each of them behaves a little bit differently in that the amount of opioid that results in an effect is different from opioid to opioid. And fentanyl is one where you require extremely small amounts in weight to create an analgesic effect, but also extremely small amounts in weight to create a respiratory depression effect, which is basically the effect of most opioids that cause your brain to turn off its drive for your lungs to expand. So essentially, if you were to give somebody enough opioid, you can stop them from breathing.
Right. And this is why sometimes first responders, when they appear on scene, are even worried to handle a patient, because if they get it on their fingertips or what have you, or inhale, then they're in big shit.
Well, so this is unvarnished, right?
Yep.
Okay. So that whole narrative that, you know, first responders who are exposed by touch to fentanyl powder will die from it is bullshit.
Okay.
And that's not to say that there shouldn't be precautions that are taken, because you're dealing with a hazard. But, you know, the stories about first responders who absorb these fentanyl analogs through their skin and therefore have an overdose event and need to be revived with naloxone, it should not be taken at face value. And in fact, some toxicology societies have described why that can't be true. And, you know, honesty is really important to combat hysteria. The last thing that we should be encouraging people to do is not help individuals who have overdosed on opioids, because the antidote to that is cheap. It's yep. called naloxone. It's effective. And you can, you know, it's literally life-saving, but delays in intervening because you're scared that you're going to get hurt by touching somebody who's overdosed can literally be the difference between life and death. You know, so let's dispense with this idea that if you touch somebody who's got fentanyl powder on them, you're going to die. It's just not the case.
We all talk about a public health crisis. Why has there been no declaration of national public health emergency by the previous government under Prime Minister Harper and under this government under Prime Minister Trudeau? Like, I'm a huge fan, as you well know, of the former health minister, Jane Philpott, because I really think that she gets it and got it. But even there, she was one of the ones that could have declared a national public health emergency and did not. The current health minister, I'm not too sure what your thoughts are on her as a successor to Minister Philpott. But why, you know, outside of Ontario, there are, you know, where our health minister actually declared a public health emergency. Why are we not seeing more of that? And if they did at a national level and then, you know, subsequent provincial levels as well, you know, what would that look like? What would that marshal in terms of dealing with this?
So I think this is emblematic of the inadequacy of our public health legislation in most provinces, but also federally. So you'd recall that our Public Health Agency of Canada arose post-SARS.
Yep.
And what we were looking to was a national body that would exercise leadership and be nimble and responsive to emerging threats to Canadian public health.
And then Harper gutted it when he came into office, or at least gutted the mandates.
I think that's fair. But what's also fair to say is that no government has given the public health agency the independence that's required to respond to an emerging hazard that is threatening public health. if we did have such an agency, I think we would have seen a different response to this public health crisis. We also would have seen a different and better response to our H1N1 pandemic influenza epidemic in 2009. But the relationship between government and the public health agency is far too interlinked than it should be. And I think that it's also quite telling that the public health agency that most resembles an independent entity is in BC, and that's the only province that did declare a public health emergency and has dedicated significant resources to managing this crisis.
Well, Ontario has as well. We did that in December.
So in terms of the resources that are being dedicated towards responding to this public health crisis, I don't think that Ontario measures up to what BC has done.
Right.
And I don't think that the moves have been nearly as bold in terms of expanding the basket of harm reduction services required to mitigate the risks of this unprecedented hazard. So why did the federal government not declare a public health emergency? I think if you talk to Minister Philpott, who's a physician and who I agree with you is a very, very smart person, she would probably tell you that the current legislative framework around public health emergencies does not provide the federal government or the public health agency with powers that would allow them to manage this public health emergency in an independent way that might actually make a difference. That's not to say that it's not a public health emergency. What it is to say is that calling it such might not have made a difference. And I think that argument does hold some water. Provincially, not as much, though. For example, where I come from in Alberta, you declare a public health emergency when you're faced with a hazard that is creating an unexpected or an unpredictable amount of health impact in terms of death or illness, where the existing measures that are available to you without declaring a public health emergency and the existing resources available to you to manage this public health crisis are not adequate, then you declare a public health emergency. And that allows you to recruit resources that were not allocated in your budget, for you to recruit human resources and physical resources in order to manage the public health emergency that you could not do without declaring it. That would allow you to tell the medical examiner's office what to do and how quickly to report. That would allow you to conscript people from within health and outside of health to assist with managing the public health emergency, and it would allow you to do it quickly. To me, the biggest tragedy of the management of this public health emergency is how slowly things are moving. And the more slowly we move, the faster this crisis is allowed to morph into something that's unmanageable. Had we dealt with this when it was a prescription opioid crisis, I think we'd be sitting on a quite a different set of circumstances now.
You know, it's funny. I mean, obviously, I'm certainly no physician, but I got to know you because I was director of government affairs at a company called Indivior that made Suboxone, which is one of the. It is, by the way, I'm not pushing it. I'm just saying that that's what it makes. And I can tell you, and I think I have told you, that so many times when I would go in and try and talk public policy and you know, a public health approach to addiction treatment and getting it kind of covered or at least watching better approaching the situation much better than they were, they would either fob me off and tell me that there was no opioid crisis or that I had no place to say anything about it. They weren't interested in talking to me. And if I did get in, oftentimes in the first couple of years, what they would do is just, you know, shunt you down to market access, because too often in the pharmaceutical industry, every company that approaches anybody else on a government side, they're not interested in talking about public policy. They're interested about talking about their product so they can drive up market share at the expense of the patient, which is just horseshit, and it doesn't help anybody. But I just remember, you know, when we talk about, you know, where this could have been addressed years ago, and I'm certainly not saying that I saw it coming, because obviously people that are a million times smarter than I'll ever be did see it coming. But certainly it is really disconcerting to know that when we were raising the flag and pounding the table and talking about treatment writ large, whether it was pharmacological or psychosocial, government's response was there is no crisis. And in one particular case, I remember being told, This is no different than any other disease that's out there. And I just, you know, that is so frustrating when you think of all the, you know, people that are laying dead or broken families or ruined lives or all three as a result of what has been going on in this country.
So I would say, well, I mean, first of all, let's be clear. You and I became friends after you left your pharmaceutical company. And also, to be fair to government, I have to admit, I didn't give you much time when you were still working for pharma, because there's sensitivity around that. I mean, we got into this mess because of relationships between pharmaceutical companies and physicians and medical schools, and the relationship between pharmaceutical companies and medical education. And yes, there are some pharmaceutical companies that don't practice in the same way as others, and put the needs of patients ahead of the needs of their corporate governance. But to not heed the calls of experts who had no other interest but that of their patients, I think was poor form on the part of government. And that goes for multiple governments of multiple stripes. And I think that, you know, to say that addiction and mental health conditions are the same as all other health conditions is fair to an extent, because it's a health condition. And I wouldn't want to stigmatize one as somehow more complex than another. But I think for folks to say that epidemiologically these conditions are the same as any other chronic health condition is ignoring what we're sitting on. We see more death from overdose than we do from motor vehicle collisions and homicides combined.
Yep.
There has never been a time in history that I think we could have said that. That this is the leading cause of injury is shocking. And it's not because we're driving around with seatbelts or because everybody's following the rules of the road. Injuries from motor vehicle collisions have not decreased that much that it explains why drug overdose is the leading cause of injury death in this country. And not just leading in terms of it's slowly taken over the rank. This is beating to death, so to speak, the number twos and three causes of injury death. The other reason that this epidemic is unique is not just because of the number of people dying, but also how much human life is lost. And what I mean by that is that the lives that are claimed by this epidemic are young people.
Yeah.
And young people in the prime of their lives, the time that they start to work, pay taxes, raise children, buy homes. They're really, really important people to a societal fabric and to an economy. And losing them affects all of us in quite direct ways.
Talk to me about treatment. You know, what does treatment look like? I know that there are pharmacological options. People know that there are psychosocial. A lot of people say, well, if they would just get the hell off the drugs in the first place, we wouldn't have a problem. So what does viable treatment look like?
Yeah, so I think... you know, let's start with what the priorities of any intervention that we apply to somebody with an opioid use disorder or an opioid addiction should be. The first and foremost is survival. And that's more in our face today than it ever was before. And that the risk of death from ongoing use of opioids, particularly street opioids like fentanyl and fentanyl analogs, is really high. And we also know that the treatments that we offer and the harm reduction measures that that are available work to save lives. So the harm reduction measures that we typically talk about are take-home naloxone kits, so that the people surrounding a loved one who has trouble with opioids or sometimes uses opioids are capacitated to save the life if something untoward happens.
And that's just an injection or nasal in it, and it reverses an overdose within what?
Well, they can come back within seconds to minutes. And then, of course, really important for people to seek out emergency medical services at the same time. Some people would require additional administration of naloxone, some medical support, and sometimes admission to hospital to manage other kind of co-occurring things that happen when somebody overdoses. But, you know, without exaggeration, naloxone saves lives. And, you know, we do now have a legislative framework that allows people to call for help without having to be worried about criminal prosecution for being around illegal substances.
Thank you very much for that, because that's a shout out to Liberal MP Ron McKinnon, who passed, or it was a private member's bill called the Good Samaritan Drug Overdose Act. And It's been a long time coming. So huge kudos to him and huge kudos to the minister, Minister Philpott, who was part of making sure that came into law. Anyway, sorry, cut you off. Yeah. Go for it.
No, absolutely. So the other harm reduction interventions that can be offered are things like drug testing. As I said, you know, people are surprised by the substances that they're exposed to. They're not always the ones that they thought they were buying and using. And we've certainly seen deaths in people who think that they're using stimulants like methamphetamine or cocaine that are cut with fentanyl to kind of potentiate a euphoria and to make the drugs cheaper. So being able to test for their drugs may have an impact on how much they use, whether they use, and whether they use with supervision, which leads me to another harm reduction measure, which is supervised drug use spaces like supervised injection facilities, which indeed saves lives. We have never had a death in a supervised injection site anywhere in the world. And that includes in Vancouver, where literally tens or hundreds of thousands of drug use episodes have occurred and nobody has died from them.
I mean, listen, this is a progressive podcast, but in 10 years of Harper government, I don't want to just dump on him, but in 10 years of Harper government, the best thing that they ever did by way of supervised injection facility was sitting on their ass and doing absolutely nothing except suing the shit out of Insight to try and close their doors. I mean, how many people did we lose in 10 years on the street, in the gutter, in the downtown east side, and in cities and communities, large and small across this country, because that government had an ideological approach to this, and it was based on ignorance, apathy, prejudice, and fear.
Well, look, if any political party continues with that mindset, it's at their peril, I think. Earlier this year, Angus Reid conducted a poll of Canadians and found that 49% of conservative voters supported supervised injection facilities, and more than two-thirds of the rest of Canadians did. So Canada is more progressive, I think, than our politicians give us credit for. And so if that continues to be the paradigm of any political party, I think it's poorly advised. I'm no politician, but that's what I think.
You should
looking
be,
at the numbers.
You should be.
No, thanks. No, and you know, and that brings me to treatment in a medical setting, because you asked what it's like, and this is why I practice medicine. It's really fun to watch the turnaround that people who have sort of been at the depths of their existence, really not enjoying their life, walking around either worried that they're going to die the next time they use or go to jail when they get caught using, can abstain from using opioids eventually when provided with what we call opioid agonist therapies with a variety of options. One is methadone, which most people have heard of. One is another called buprenorphine, or the trade name Suboxone. There are now emerging agonist therapies like slow-release oral morphine, and for some patients, supervised injectable opioid agonist therapies, all of which have tremendous promise in terms of reducing the likelihood of death from opioid use. And I think what we really do need to get better at doing is offering those treatments in a way that incentivizes patients to seek them out early in their kind of journey through substance use disorder. We don't do a good job of that. I mean, offering banker's hours for a life-saving medical treatment for somebody who's trying to get by with, you know, a job and trying to hold their family together and trying to make rent, you know, that's while suffering from a substance use condition is really a tall order. And I think that we need to be more responsive and patient-centered around that. So that's treatment. In terms of the pharmacological aspect of treatment. And then many patients may benefit from, you know, additional psychosocial therapies, depending on kind of what underpins their addiction, what are the variables that contribute to their substance use. Many of them have histories of trauma. Many of them are victims of racism or domestic violence or systemic discrimination that are all kind of contributors to substance use, that, you know, providing a supportive environment and some psychosocial therapies to address those can be quite life-changing.
So if you could have the health ministers, federal, provincial, territorial, in a room, what would be the, you know, three things that you would tell them that they need to do right now to make a difference in this?
Well, there's probably There's probably more than three, but I'll tell you, if I was given three, the first one, without question, would be to address criminal drug policy in this country. We are now at a point where, you know, you hear people saying it's time for a conversation about decriminalization. Mm. It's actually long past time for a conversation. We need to go ahead and do this.
Yeah, look at Portugal. Portugal is a fantastic example of what works when you use evidence to change policy.
Yeah, Portugal is, and you know, remember that Portugal did this without a whole lot of evidence, but a lot of logic.
Yep.
And now Portugal can serve as an example for the rest of us, where, you know, it's very difficult to connect the dots in a straight line between a policy change and a public health change, but it's impossible to deny that the number of people dying from drug overdose in Portugal has dramatically decreased. They, in Europe, they measure drug overdose deaths in the per million ratio, per million population. In Canada, we are now measuring it in the per 100,000. And for an example, in Alberta last year, in the first 45 weeks of the year, we saw 462 deaths from fentanyl and fentanyl analogs alone. In Portugal in 2017, from all drug overdoses, they lost three in a million.
Oh, my God.
So so three per million versus, you know, about 50 times that in Alberta. Now, Portugal introduced a decriminalization approach when they were dealing with cheap heroin causing death that was imported from Afghanistan and Pakistan, I think, mm-hmm. And decided that they would take a human approach, in that they didn't legalize drugs per se, but when somebody was caught with drugs that were illegal in amounts that looked like they were using them for personal use, they were brought in front of a panel that they called a dissuasion panel that was composed of a lawyer, a social worker, I think, and somebody with an addiction counseling or a psychological background. And they talked to them like human beings to try and find out, is there something that we can do to reduce the impacts of this substance use on you, to make sure that you stay safe, and if you'd like, to be able to help you stop using. And if it was somebody who was brought in front of these panels multiple times, they might be a little bit more persuasive about the offering of addiction treatment. But they didn't go to jail. And in Canada, we're increasingly seeing that people dying from opioid overdoses are dying alone in their homes, in a place like Calgary in the suburbs. Those are very difficult people to provide treatment to in a context where they're criminalized for their substance use. Why would anybody go to a doctor and tell them that they're doing something that should land them in jail in our current legislative framework? Of course they wouldn't. They have a hard enough time telling a doctor how much they smoke or that they eat a couple of donuts for breakfast.
No kidding.
To expect that they come in and say, I need help for this thing that I do that makes me a criminal, is really an unfair expectation. So the first thing that I would ask a room full of ministers and MPs to do is exactly what Nate Erskine is suggesting that we do, and that's decriminalize drugs for personal use.
Nice. I totally agree with that. And he's one of the bravest ones, I think, right now in the Liberal caucus. And there's a couple in the NDP caucus as well. But I really wish that our progressive government would get their ass in gear and get in line and start actually paying attention to what good folks like you were saying. So what are the other couple that you have? And then last question after that, we'll sum it up.
Okay, well, I think that, you know, as I said, the remarkable turnaround that patients with addiction can experience when offered evidence-based treatments for opioid use disorder is a story that kind of sells itself as far as I'm concerned. And we need to provide low threshold access to those treatments. That means that, you know, any time that somebody who's in the throes of addiction has an aha moment and feels like, I feel like this is the time for change, we should be there for them. You know, when somebody has chest pains, we don't tell them to, you know, on a Friday night, we don't tell them, we'll wait till Monday morning and we'll see what we can do. And similarly, when somebody who has disordered use of substances in today's climate decides that it's time for change, the difference between Friday and Monday could literally be life and death. And we need to be there for them on the Friday night rather than tell them, call us on Monday morning. We don't do that right now. And I think that we really need to. That's going to require us to be creative, and it's going to require a bold allocation of resources across the country, not just in big cities, but in rural areas. Using, you know, whether we have to use technology, whether we need to approach this from a medical training perspective, all ideas need to be not just explored, but executed across the country. And then I think we need to get much more bold and direct a ton of resources towards harm reduction efforts across the basket of things that could be offered. That's not just supervised drug use spaces. That's not just take-home naloxone kits. It should be naloxone everywhere. It should be available in gas stations and nightclubs and schools. And it means drug testing available to people who would like it. It means that, you know, in Edmonton, there's a great example of a supervised injection facility that will be set up in a hospital. Why not?
Yeah.
In fact, for so many reasons, we should be putting harm reduction interventions in proximity to healthcare, because that's one of the purposes of harm reduction, is to provide an avenue into healthcare services for people who otherwise wouldn't access them. Our mayor in Edmonton calls harm reduction kind of an off-ramp for people who are on a path that they would like to get off of. We need to provide as many of those off-ramps as possible for people who would like to make a health behavior change. So those are the three things. I think, you know, without the first one, without addressing the criminal drug policy issue in Canada, we can throw all our resources at everything else, but we're not going to make the headway that we need to.
Well, my last question was going to be about naloxone, and you've basically answered it, and that is it should be everywhere. You know, I know that there's some resistance, I think, to the idea of even putting it in schools or wherever, but I figure if we can put defibrillators in every arena, in every building, we can damn well do the same thing for naloxone when we've got kids that are overdosing at schools, for God's sake.
Well, look, I would say this. This is a safer drug than aspirin.
Yeah.
And you could buy a Tylenol at a gas station. Why should you not be able to get a life-saving naloxone kit from a gas station and from a school and from a nightclub? I just can't see a good reason for that. You know, you hear some folks on the other side saying, well, it's, you know, giving an antidote to an opioid overdose is licensed for people to indiscriminately use. There is no evidence to suggest that that occurs. What it does say is, look, we care what happens to you. And for that reason, we're providing you with a life-saving resource that you can get without disclosing why you're getting it. It could be for your friend. It could be for yourself. It could be for a loved one in your family. It could just be because you want to keep it in your car in case you're driving downtown and you see somebody down and you'd like to help. And that's kind of the culture that you'd hope in a public health crisis like this sort of takes hold, where everybody recognizes that, you know, every death has been somebody's someone, and it's a matter of time before it strikes close to everybody's home. Like, think of the butterfly effect in Alberta of losing 462 people by Remembrance Day last year to opiate overdose.
Crazy. It's crazy, and it's so sad, and it's so preventable. And, you know, you see it every day. I saw it for 6 years with Indivior when I would get to meet patients. And you're quite right, seeing the transformation from literally, you know, at the bottom of the barrel, the bottom of hope, and, you know, seeing them over the course of a year. And that transformation is incredible. And I'll just close by saying that, first of all, thank you so much for what you do. And I, you know, when I was still with the company, I remember meeting a conservative MP, and I always like to tell this anecdote because I think it contrasts well with somebody like you and individuals like you who are working every day to change lives and change hearts and minds. But I remember meeting with a conservative MP who was at the time the parliamentary secretary to the health minister. And I remember talking to him about the importance of treatment. And because in this individual's riding, he had a very large clinic for treatment. I think it was one of the first step clinics, if I'm not mistaken. And I remember I asked him if he knew about it, and he says, "Well, yes, I I know all about that place. He said, those are the people that go out and pee all over the streets. And what we really need to be doing is moving that clinic into an industrial zone so that it won't bother, the other residents. And I just look at that and I thought it was such an ugly sentiment. But too often, that is what I think drives a lot of these conversations. But what you do and the way you talk about it and the way you live it every single day is such a contrast. And thank God for people like you, and thank God for the work that you do, and thank God that the information that you're giving now and the compassion and the decency that you're giving and that you clearly show and believe is starting to win the day. So my friend, thank you so much for being on. As I say, first Politico supporter and hopefully next leader of the Alberta, the Alberta Party? Hey, listen, if David Swan can run the Liberal Party of Alberta as a doctor, I'm sure you could do both too.
No, practicing medicine is far too much fun, but thanks, Cameron. It's been a slice.
Okay, thanks, my friend. Take care.
Okay, bye now.
Thanks again for tuning in. First show, a little bit pumped, kind of anxious to see what people think. I know Mike and Leanne had a great time. Really appreciate Hakeek having been on the show. But I also want to hear from you as well. So if you have comments, if you think the episode sucked, if you thought it was good, send them over to me at CDN Politico on Twitter. Or you can also email cdnpolitico@gmail.com. Of course, check out canadianpolitico.ca, which is our nascent website for our nascent podcast, and we still have to build that up a little bit. But we will be talking to you soon, and you're going to hopefully get to know all of us, Mike, myself, Leanne, and a couple other co-hosts that'll be coming soon. So be sure to tune in, and until then, have a great couple of days.